gonna rock these shakes, gonna scream my name, make you shout now, honey, gonna make you shout.
Whether you're an independent artist looking to take their career to the next level, or you're a fan that just loves to discover new artists and new original music, Making a Scene has exactly what you're looking for. For the indie artist, we have articles on music business, gear reviews, recording techniques, and interviews with industry professionals. For the fan, we introduce you to new artists every day with our in-depth artist interviews and insightful CD reviews. Nobody gives you more. Making a Scene truly is the number one resource for the indie artist and the fans that love them. Go to makingascene.org and become part of the indie revolution. And now, here's a double shot from our featured artist today, Stephen Jacques. And stay tuned for that interview. It comes up right after these songs.
Only a mile. When I was a lad, tried to lay down.
was Stephen Jacques from his brand new release, and we got Stephen on the line right now. Hey, Stephen, how you doing?
Doing great here in Richmond, Virginia on a 96-degree summer day.
Cool. Okay. Now, you know, this is your first time on our show, and we always like to get things rolling by giving our fans this opportunity to get to know who you are as an artist. And the best way to do that is by your journey, where you came from, how you got to where you are today. So give us the story of Stephen Jacques.
Yeah, so as far as the music and the artistic side goes, when I was younger, I was always kind of a night owl, staying up watching Johnny Carson and Saturday Night Live. And I probably didn't miss an episode, but I was glued into all those entertainment things every week. But to start up with some humor, well, in the 70s, with 8-tracks being in the house, Elvis and Johnny Cash, probably some Joni Mitchell, were running nonstop in the house, and my dad would, you know, crash out on the couch or whatever, fall asleep, and those 8-tracks just kept running, right? But my dad also had a friend that lived behind us, so, you know, it's family members that were singing some and neighbors, but we had this friend behind us that my dad used to meet at the fence line, and then they'd have a couple drinks, and they'd go up to his house, and they actually had this microphone hooked into this little boom box, and on like a kid's stereo, and they'd sing loudly into this boom box. It was hilarious. So sitting on the floor there, I'm 12 years old, they're belting out these like 70s songs like John Denver or whatever. And then there was an aquarium in the basement, okay? So then they're starting naming fish. So you see where this is going. It was just a comical little thing in Richmond, Virginia as a little kid. But really, it was fun to grab the mic every so often and give it a try, see what it feels like. But my Italian grandfather from New Jersey was a multi-instrumentalist in the early 1900s, and he did some national tours with a jazz band. And so he was always on the piano down in Virginia Beach playing songs like Somewhere My Love and stuff like that for my grandmother. And my godmother, Aunt Carol, she used to sing all the time the blues or whatever at, like, family holidays and songs like Summertime. And then my French grandmother Jacques from down in New Orleans, she lived in Virginia Beach also, and she was from New Orleans and brought sort of that spirit and vibe of the Crescent City into her home in Virginia Beach. So I think she and actress Nanette Fabre were distant relatives, and she, you know, used to talk about all the good times down in New Orleans. So she was always dancing around and kind of nutty like the rest of my family. But into high school, we had a lot of Beatles and Stones parties on the weekend night. And so some wild times in Richmond, Virginia, having a good time. And during those years, I was about 16. My good friend David Wood, who's now an art historian, he taught me my first few chords after school on his little Yamaha acoustic. And he was a big Beatles fan, so... But I never had time to be in a band because I was always working a part-time job and I hadn't practiced enough, or maybe I, you know, back then I couldn't afford a guitar. So it was into college, in the college years, you know, a little later, listening to bands all the time. And then, you know, a friend of the family down there, he used to do a lot of stuff with Danny Thomas on TV for St. Jude's fundraisers, attorney Pete Decker down in Norfolk. So I was always inspired by friends and people like that. So that's how I kind of got, you know, kind of a... But I wasn't singing on stage or anything or doing any of that and even writing anything until I was in my late 40s.
Okay. So it took you a little while. Well, what was that moment that kind of, you know, said to you, all right, this is where I need to take my career path? What was that crossroad moment for you?
Here's what it was. I was in Charlottesville, Virginia, and I was a builder. And Bear Stearns came along in 2010 or so, and the real estate building scene came to a stop with a few hours in the afternoon free, and I was piddling around, and I was a builder for 18, 19 years there. And when things came to a standstill with building and real estate, I mean, it was just like a valve was shut off. So one of my neighbors who I built this big house for was a UVA professor, University of Virginia. And I was, you know, he saw me out there and I chit-chat with him. I'm like, well, I hit a dead spot here. And he was like, look, do something you love. Do something you're passionate about. Don't do this. Don't do that. So within like a week or so, I went to my dining room table and wrote down and started, you know, trying to get something down because I had a good amount of free time until we started our next custom home to build. And, you know, with the economy, we didn't know where that was going to start. So that's when the first record, Intrepid Souls, was born. But I had been playing guitar since I was 16, 18, 19. So, you know, just strumming and strumming around for decades there. I mean, we're talking 25 years or so before I actually wrote that first song in my 40s. So then enters producer Mark Graham, who I somehow found in Charlottesville, Virginia at a place called the Sound Studios. And he had worked in Nashville and LA and did a little work with Stevie Wonder. So the first record, Intrepid Souls, without any lyrics, I was back and forth to that. And then, of course, always something happens that near at the end. There's an earthquake in Virginia at the end when I'm trying to finish this record. And I've got a great guy, Dan Sebring, in Charlottesville on harp and fiddle. So the building's shaking, and it's just one. Dan's father gets in a car wreck, I think. And it's all these things just trying to finish that first record. But I didn't have any lyrics on it for quite a while. And then, of course, thereafter, it was in 2012, I ended up meeting everybody at the Sound of Music Studios in Richmond with our second CD. So that's kind of how that first record started.
Okay.
I must have taken 25 trips to the studio before I got Intrepid Souls done.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the new release. When you were putting this together, what was your goal for this?
Well, you know, as a songwriter, you get inspiration from different things, but, you know, this the current one is actually my ninth release called Soul Hydraulics. And this one, there are a lot of different themes led up to this. We had Dreams from a Canyon, Moonlight on Wings, and Submission, Admission. The current one is sort of the industrial and the tactile and some blue-collar things and some guy working a forklift in New Jersey near the Jersey Shore, tossing love around small town. So I had a lot of fictional characters, but also songs that were inspired by people I met in Richmond, Virginia. People always say, what's the inspiration of Muse? But a song is never planned out for me. It just comes to me. I don't think about music during the day. I guess I'm giving myself a break, but I know when the time is that I'm going to grab that guitar and go for it. And, you know, a lot of times I'll actually write some song titles down, and I haven't talked to that many other songwriters. Sometimes maybe they're secret, right, about how exactly they come up with. For me, I would write down 10 or 11 or 12 song titles and kind of a general idea of what I wanted for the record. And then I'd put those song titles down, and then I would start building something. So for me, one thing is I don't remember writing any of the songs. The other thing is they usually took me less than 15 minutes to write, and I always did it when I was kind of, I could just feel it. I was ready to do it, you know? And the songwriting process is very, I think it's different for everybody. I think Tom Petty said, you know, he would get down a lot of lyrics and then, you know, and then he's setting the melody and stuff later. But with the current one, Soul Hydraulics, it was a lot of some fictional characters, some people that I'd meet at the gym or somebody leaning up against the building. During COVID, we had a lot of time on our hands, right? A lot of silent time, quiet time on our hands during lockdown or whatever. So in that silence, in a quiet room, you can really, really get some stuff done and get focused. And so the current record, Soul Hydraulics, produced by John Moran, who worked with many bands such as Sparkle Horse, Joan Osborne, Cracker, Carbon Leaf, and worked a little bit with Susanna, the Bangles. But so after that first record, I had found the Sound of Music studios in Richmond because I was on a New York City subway, and I met this lady who was like in the media or working for a publicist, and I was like, I don't know what the next move is going to be. I moved to this such and such town, and she's like, why don't you look on a CD of who one of your favorite bands and look up and see who they use for the recording studios. Duh, right? So I did that, and Sound of Music Studios, the band was Cracker, in Richmond, Virginia. So then I meet Alan Weatherhead, the great one, and the great John Moran, and Miguel Lovistondo was the manager there, and David Lowry, I guess, was of Cracker, was a partner with the ownership of that. So that's where Dreams from a Canyon, the 2012 record, came along. And then Alan Weatherhead, who was known for the Cardigans and Cracker and Hotel Lights and many other records, he was the producer and multi-instrumentalist on CDs number 2 through like 7 or 8. So there was so much experience with Alan, and he had, years ago when he was younger, he even had one of his records, I guess it was a Daniel Johnston record he did that was written up by David Bowie. So Alan could play 5-6 instruments or something, and so he and I worked on Submission Admission and Moonlight on Wings and Surfing the American Dust Bowl. So those were like 6 records we did together, and then after that that was under the Box of Moxie name. And then after that, I started doing a couple solo records, one being Charmed to Death last year, pre-COVID, and then Soul Hydraulics, which is the one that we're releasing now. So that's kind of a roundabout answer to your question.
Okay. Now, let's talk about going in the studio. You know, having a song gives you something to say, but the voice in which you say it in is developed in the studio, and every artist has their sound, their unique identifier, and that's where that all is evolved from. Every artist has their way of working in that environment in the studio. So tell me a little bit about how you like to work in that environment in the studio.
Well, it's an interesting question. The number one thing, let's take Alan Weatherhead, for example, be over-prepared before you get there. Every producer is different, right? He's a recording engineer, a multi-instrumentalist, and a producer, right? So I'm coming in there for the first time in 2012 with a very accomplished guy. So the main thing with the studio is one take after another, one take after another, be way prepared. And it's a good question because I think you find your voice and you get to know the song and get to know yourself more and more through this process. Sometimes it's hot in the studio. Sometimes you're sweating, you're actually sweating out, and you keep re-singing and re-singing. But one of the things in the studio that I like to do is not have them stop when I have made a mistake and to keep on going, because you know, we can always edit that out and work it out. But there's some, for my singing process in the studio, there's always something for me where I want to sing the whole thing through. Now, with John Moran as the producer, he has a little bit of a different approach. He'll take the guitar and the song and just sing the whole thing through together, right? With that and that. And he's kind of like Van Gogh. He's kind of like the artiste painter guy. He sits back, kind of get the vibe of where you're trying to go with this. Kind of the artsy, really cool, really understands the musician well. So in working with them, that's been this record and the last record. So the producers, you know, drive a lot of that, but with the way everything is tracking, you're doing one take after another, and oftentimes you're looking straight at the guy through a glass. He's in the box back there while you're doing guitar or vocals, and a lot of times they'll jump out of that box so you're not distracted by them, right? When you're singing the vocals or playing guitar, you're just looking straight at them. So each and Alan, sometimes we're out at his residence. He had like a studio set up out there. But the main thing about all of the recording stuff is to be way over prepared before you get there. You don't want to be. I remember when I was younger, you know, like I was still figuring out some things when I'm in the studio and like rewriting some of the lyrics, which is very embarrassing when you're, but you know, you got to start somewhere, you know?
Right.
So it's one take after another in the studio though. And it's, you know, you're tracking, you got the bass player one day or you got the drummer, and a lot of times with that I'm watching them, right? So I think the producer creates a certain thing, but, you know, I can't say any, you know, I can't say too much more about that, but except for any people going in there is be way prepared and really know that. And when I was younger, I think I made the mistake of not practicing it enough and not being prepared enough and writing some of the songs at the last minute, so... that just increases the number of trips to the studio and creates a lot of frustration for the producer, you know.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about getting it out there. You know, once you, of course, have it recorded and you get it at you, you know, all together and mastered and ready to roll, you need to put together your team in order to create the buzz, create the kind of... you know, radio airplay and so on and so forth. And you're working with Tinderbox and Krista. Tell me a little bit about that relationship.
Yeah, so it wasn't... So Tinderbox Music, fantastic publicist out of Minneapolis. So, you know, finding the right publicist and finding a publicist for the first time can be, you know, can be... challenging trying to figure that out. So what happened to me was a record I did, I think it was number 7, called Submission Admission, okay, and under Box of Moxie, M-O-X-I-E. That was the little band name I had for like the first 7 records. So this record, Submission Admission, gets ranked or voted number 7 of the top 30 albums of the month at WRIR Richmond Radio, right? Independent radio in Richmond. So that record was the one I connected with Tinderbox, I think, through finding them through LinkedIn. And I think Alan Weatherhead knew them too. But anyway, there's some common friends or something. So when I got that ranking for Submission Admission, I didn't even... No, I don't think anybody called me. I think I ran across it on Google because they're always cranking out these monthly reports. So once that happened, I got the, you know, I emailed Tinderbox Music and sent them the record and said, hey, you know, so when building that relationship with the publicist and getting it going is so important because they can get it out to the world, but When that first one that went out to the publicist, Submission got out there, the NACC, the National Association for College and Community Radio Stations, had it as number 29 of top 30 for new ads to like radio station rotations, to like their library or their spins, right? So that was a big, big breakthrough, I think, for that record, Submission Admission. So then, you know, you're in the world of a publicist, which is getting it out to radio stations and music journalists, reviewing the records, And, you know, that really takes you from 0 miles an hour to 100 miles an hour, because now you're plugged in, you got a great producer, and putting the team of musicians together with six or seven, with six of those records with Alan, we had a drummer and Alan and myself, and we kind of did the whole thing, right? And then it wasn't until this most recent record, Soul Hydraulics, that we said, hey, COVID times, let's kind of put a Richmond, Virginia super group together. And so we had a total of 10 musicians on the current record. So, you know, there's been dozens of reviews written up for Submission Admission. I think we had one more that Tinderbox Music put out there called Saltwater Magic. And then, of course, the solo release of Charmed to Death was out there, too. So, you know, even when they rank some of these rankings of the top 1,000, you know, records in the country, and you're looking up some of these charts, I think Charmed to Death was number 273 at one point for one of these ranking systems for every genre in the country. You know, if you don't have a publicist and you kind of go it alone, you know, it's a, it can be a very challenging thing without having the connection to the music industry and sort of getting it out there to the world.
Yeah, well, that's for sure. Now, one of the things that a lot of musicians have been struggling with today is when you release a product, a recorded product, the consumer no longer looks at it as something to purchase. It's now available on their phone 24/7. It's free. It's a different economic world for especially the independent artist. How has this new shift in the consumer's perception of recorded music affected you as an artist?
Well, that's a great question. You know, a lot of things you don't know. So many people can just listen to a few seconds of a song, right? The only data I'm really getting back is Spotify listens, website visits. You know, somebody could listen to, I don't know how they run the data, for example. I know from the publicist, you know, as far as the radio station feedback through the NACC, we'll get some data that comes back from the publicist on light, medium, or heavy rotations. But then a lot of people run Facebook ads or this and that, and I don't know if they're listening. Well, a lot of the charts will show you if somebody's just listening to, you know, 30 seconds of it or the full song. We had a song called Hatter a Surf Buzz that we put out there and the publicist helped with, and that had like 70,000 listens on Spotify. But then there's also data where you can see, in some of that you can see how many listeners, how many times, and I think the average person listened to that 2.5 times. That was huge. That was a big hit for us. Hatter a Surf Buzz off the record called Submission Admission. But, you know, the funny thing about music now versus opening that Saran wrap in the 70s and 80s and open that vinyl record is it's sort of a parallel universe. I mean, it's, you know, I'll get some feedback data from the publicist and I'll, you know, and I'll see the hits on Spotify. But, you know, it's really the artists, the musicians getting paid much less because of, you know, a penny a click or whatever, and that whole thing that David Lowry and Cracker had with the whole Spotify music industry thing that was going on a couple of years ago. But it's I guess you can say I get some data, but it's kind of hard to discern a lot of it. If I answered your question there, I did my best.
That's okay. Well, you know, it's like a double-edged sword now. You know, even though there is less economic return on recorded music, it does give the artist more reach and ability to touch different consumers. And if you look at how consumers are actually listening to music, it's a different experience. You know, I grew up in the, you know, my music awakening was in the late 60s, early 70s. And, you know, you would buy an album, you would listen to the side one, you would listen to side two, you know, and again, you had mentioned, you know, 8-tracks, you know, we'd get an 8-track tape and you would, you know, put it in and you would listen to the whole album, you know, from front to back. You know, and it's, you know, you can't listen to like Dark Side of the Moon on shuffle. You know, it just doesn't work. But today, you know, the consumer is kind of listening to music. They're not concerned with genre. They're not really concerned with even the artist. They're right. concerned with creating a soundtrack, creating and curating a playlist that fits a activity or a mood that they want to create. You know what I mean?
Right. And, well, another thing that we've had, too, in the, sort of the same vein, is we have Notorious Liz out of New York City, who's an independent radio promoter. So here's the thing that's great. The great thing is we got the internet. It's going out to the world. Somebody in Sweden, somebody in Australia, somebody in the Philippines is listening to your music, right? But back in the 70s and 80s, you'd grab an album, read the credits on the back, sit around with your group of friends, but now you've got, and listen to the whole record together, right? So now you've got a playlist, which is just like a soundtrack from a movie, right? You've got your favorite stuff in there. And then that takes away from the number of people that are actually listening to radio, right? So mm-hmm. now we've got this world where instead of NBC and ABC and CBS, we've got Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and this whole different information thing that's going on. So with the publicist and with promoting music, you're kind of trying to hit it from all angles, right? Music reviews from the journalists out in Europe and Los Angeles and all over the country. You know, and then you've got all the radio stations. I've got one, of course, Tinderbox with community and college radio and all the music journalists. And then Notorious Liz out of New York City, who's FM commercial for example, now we have Come to Me Marie. It's the first song on Soul Hydraulics, which has a national street date of September 3rd. So that's going to be one single that she's focusing on, is getting that out, right? So, you know, it's, for me, this is the 11th year. And I think, you know, I just started really getting traction into that 9th year, maybe. And had one other publicist that worked with a little bit in Oregon a few years ago before I learned about Tinderbox Music. But, you know, you just try to, the main thing about music is love it, you know, do what you love. And I think it inspires a lot of other people. If you're doing what you love and what you're passionate about, you know, one thing you got to say, though, it can be not a money pit, but there's a lot of, just with the physical distribution of CDs or the whole income side of music is, you know, how do musicians make money, right? Touring, and then COVID comes along, right? Shut down for that, right?
Yep.
I was actually lucky because for me personally, I was a builder for 19 years, so the real estate industry shuts down, the building lumber prices go up, COVID comes along, shuts down even radio station visits because I do a lot of stuff in California and West and all over the country, radio stations. So every button I was pushing, nothing was going anywhere. So we actually did 24 songs in the studio over this last 17-month period, right? So tour can't do that. Radio station can't do that, right? The whole COVID thing just flipped the whole music thing upside down. And then you had guys like Jeff Tweedy of Wilco or Johnny Hickman of Cracker. You see them doing these live shows on Instagram. God bless them for doing it. So, talking about starving artists, I mean, think about the artists that for a, you know, 16, 18 month period are shut down with any tour income. And, you know, just really, really a tough thing for people who make a living at it.
Well, what were some of the things that you were doing during COVID that allowed you to stay connected to your fans?
Well, that's interesting. For me, I wasn't doing... I did a couple live Facebook shows. You know, we got the Charm to Death record out, which was achieved during that period. And you know what? It was in the studio the whole time. We literally did 2.5 records worth of recording. So, you know, the radio stations, hundreds of them were playing the songs. And, you know, we were working I think we had somebody out of New York who was doing some advertisement through, like, Facebook. And, you know, people, just like when you hear a song on the radio, for people communicating, you don't really have very much of the audience coming back at you. You'll get likes on Facebook or likes on Instagram, but, you know, I could just say, you know, people aren't sending, like, you don't hear, like, personal emails from anybody. You know, you're getting reports back from the publicist, you're getting likes or your information data from social media. But for us, I was writing songs like crazy. And just, you know, when COVID came along, it was exercising some paperwork for my business, planning some tours. And then, of course, the Chicago-Detroit one I had planned 5 or 6 months ahead of time got canceled. Even when we worked that out way ahead of time, that got canceled during COVID. So I put some money and a lot of time to getting that scheduled, and that got canceled. So, you know, you're sitting there hitting every one of these buttons trying to make something go, and it just won't go.
Yeah.
But I was very much entertained by all the guys who had by the guys like Jeff Tweedy of Wilco, who had these awesome organized live streams on Instagram. I think I did a couple myself, but yeah, so it was pretty challenging, and hopefully we're gonna come out of this very soon. And there's a lot more live music happening now. If you some more, like the Wilco show that's coming to Richmond, they just announced it's changed to Browns Island, which is an outdoor venue. So that went from indoor to outdoor. So as the COVID, as the variant, the Delta variant has come through, now there's another pivot, you know, there's another adjustment, a pivot, you know, taking place now to do whatever people have to do to accommodate that.
Okay. Well, you know, I really appreciate you coming on the show and talking with us. And we're going to give everyone out there a double shot from your new release. You guys are going to love this, man. Just turn up loud. Screw the neighbors. We're going to have some fun.
Waters ran through my veins. There were fish all around, spinners, bobbers, hooks abound. Memories of age-old dreams come to recall when we feel love.
A little beach town. gonna rock the shake, gonna scream my name, make you shout now, honey, gonna make you shout.
Whether you're an independent artist looking to take their career to the next level, or you're a fan that just loves to discover new artists and new original music, Making a Scene has exactly what you're looking for. For the indie artist, we have articles on music business, gear reviews, recording techniques, and interviews with industry professionals. For the fan, we introduce you to new artists every day with our in-depth artist interviews and insightful CD reviews. Nobody gives you more. Making a Scene truly is the number one resource for the indie artist and the fans that love them. Go to makingascene.org and become part of the indie revolution.
Shake!